You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for August 14th, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the very, very classy Ameristar Casino in Council Bluffs, Iowa. It's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Hey, Driftglass.
Hey, Blue Gal.
And I just want to point out that Ameristar Casino in Council Bluffs, Iowa is the most expensive hotel room in Iowa. And I'm not making fun of that because we live a cornfield away from Iowa.
Yeah.
And I get it. But people that are making the point of not being able to imagine Donald Trump campaigning in Council Bluffs are making a real, you know, or Metro Omaha, as they call it.
Yeah.
Are making a really good point, which is this campaign is not going to be run that way.
No, he'll live in his plane.
Well, he could live on his plane. Yeah. That's true.
Why wouldn't he do that? I mean, I'm sure it's
well,
fully,
and as you said, there are private country clubs, I'm sure, where Donald Trump could find a home. Yeah.
And this is Council Bluffs, by the way. Virtually every summer, my family would drive west to do our summer vacation. And it ended a variety of ways over a number of years. But it would be a straight shot down I-80. So, and so we would, you know, we would stop in Burlington to see relatives. And then we'd just keep right on going. And we would end up usually Council Bluffs. And then you cross over into Omaha, where my dad's relatives lived. And on we would head to Colorado, Arizona, and points west. So I know the country pretty well. It's flat. It's pretty. In the summer, in a hot summer, it is unbearable.
That Ameristar Casino does have jacuzzi suites, so we could go there. I have to tell you, that's my weakness.
Well, you know who's going to be in Iowa for the next few days?
I know. Bernie Sanders.
Charlie Pierce.
Charlie Pierce? Drop everything.
Yeah, he said he's staying in the same place where, I can't think. I can't think of his name. Big Bopper died in a plane crash.
Oh, yeah. And Big Bopper and The Day the Music Died.
Yes. Yeah. Why can't I think of that? Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly.
Thank you. So more coffee.
Start over. Is he staying where?
Yeah, he's apparently staying in the same place that Buddy Holly last performed before he died. Good for him. But I checked. It's a bit of a drive.
Yeah, it is.
I would have thrown everyone in the van and, you know, hostage driven them across state lines to hang out with Charlie Pierce for a day or so. But it's a bit too far. And I'm sure Brother Pierce is going to be busy.
I'm sure he is too. But at some point, you and Brother Pierce need to share a beer.
Yeah, well, he gets down to Chicago every now and then, and I'm sure at some point he will be within 100 miles of us or a train ride, and we'll make that happen.
We got a letter from he wants to go. I'll just call him Alan.
Okay.
It's not Alan Combs. And I wanted to start off by reading that and talk a little bit. Greetings. I have enjoyed the show for several years and support your work with a monthly contribution. Thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
However, on your podcast today, you talked about Hillary and did not mention Bernie Sanders' name. This follows the corporate media meme off totally ignoring Bernie Sanders. I'm totally disappointed because a comparison of Hillary and Bernie's policies demonstrate that Bernie is light years ahead and more progressive.
He is.
Hillary Clinton's environmental positions are very suspect. Thus, I am very disturbed with your recent podcast. Sincerely. And I said to him that we take your criticism to heart and we'll keep that in the forefront of thought in future podcasts. I did find it ironic that not mentioning Bernie Sanders' name is not, you know, is sort of
an endorsement.
Well, no, it's sort of the counter to say her name, which is what the activists at Netroots Nation wanted Bernie Sanders to do about Sandra Bland. So, we did want to talk about sort of sensitivity during the primary season.
Yeah.
Not in a patronizing way, but just to sort of deep breath and get a little perspective.
A little history.
There's a lot of yelling going on right now.
A little history about primary season.
Yeah. Not in a patronizing way, because people are passionate, and that passion is a good thing.
Yeah.
But as I pointed out to you at dinner, and then I want you to take the mic for on this, Driftglass. Primary season is pretty much the only time anyone pays attention to liberals.
Yeah, or any group like that.
Yeah.
The only time Black Lives Matter is going to get a headline, frankly, is by...
As connected to the political election process.
Right. It is to get in front of where all the cameras are pointed.
Right.
And all the cameras are pointed at the political process. Mm-hmm. I think it's a strategic mistake, not tactical error, because they got headlines. I think it's a strategic mistake to lump Bernie Sanders and Hillary and all Republicans together as those guys, because intervening and disrupting Bernie Sanders is light years different than disrupting the Jeb Bush campaign, which in fact happened today.
This is a nascent movement.
Yeah.
And they have a wonderful problem to solve.
Right.
Which is, we now have everyone's attention.
Right.
How do we manage that?
Mm-hmm.
There are political movements that take years to get anyone's attention.
Yep.
And here, Black Lives Matter justifiably has people's attention. And now they're being called to account for how they behave based on the amount of attention they're getting. And they did protest Jeb Bush today.
Yeah, exactly.
They did attempt to protest at Hillary Clinton campaign. Now, Hillary Clinton is an exceptional candidate. I tried to say this on Twitter and made somebody very upset, and I didn't mean to. And after I explained myself with seven tweets later, I realized I'm not going to tweet about Black Lives Matter anymore because you can't have a conversation on Twitter.
No, about anything. About anything except, dick jokes.
It's like going on Tinder to find romance.
Yeah.
It's just, you can't do it. So Hillary Clinton is a former first lady.
Yeah.
And as a former first lady, she is entitled to Secret Service protection.
Right.
And what I was trying to say was that as an activist, activists have to be aware of the security protocol if they're going to disrupt any event.
Yes.
If the place is surrounded by federal agents, your behavior in disrupting an event is going to be different than it might be in a place where there's no security. That does not mean that Hillary Clinton should protect herself from Black Lives Matter, and that was what got someone upset. Mandate to protect is what the Secret Service's mandate is. That's how they put it. That's how they discuss what their job is, mandate to protect.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean Hillary Clinton needs to protect herself from Black Lives Matter.
No.
So let me get that out there. Woo. But talk a bit about sort of the grabbing the microphone at this point, not just in terms of Black Lives Matter, which we sort of get now that they are going off in that direction. And also they are modifying their behavior in terms of putting to words what they really want.
Yeah.
And that takes time. And they sort of went at it, they got the gift of a lot of attention ahead of really formulating how to communicate that, their wishes to the audience that they now have.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And there's the model that I hat tip Charlie Pierce. I'm sure other people have done it here. I think it's a fair comparison to make is with ACT UP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's an urgent life or death situation. We need action right now, and we are going to grab everyone we can by the lapels and demand they pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Agree with
we
it.
We don't care who we piss off in doing that because we're dying.
But we're going to commandeer Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to bust up gay weddings.
Yeah.
Because that seems like that's a kind of a waste of time. We're not going to spend...
Yeah, we're going to go to the Food and Drug Administration.
Exactly.
And sit there in the hallway until they listen to us.
Exactly. The people who can actually do something about this and who have been ignoring us and pretending we don't exist or treating us in a cavalier way or whose agenda is opposite to ours or worse. Just they don't give a shit. Live, die is probably your own fault anyway. Those people, but it's primary season. And every political reporter in America is either at a studio or on a bus or on a plane or on a bicycle following around candidates. So there's a cluster of microphones and cameras pointed at various people. And every year around this time, usually a little bit later, it becomes
every 4 years.
Every 4 years. Yeah. Every 4 years around this time, It's a fight over which group gets to grab the microphone today. Mm-hmm. And it's not that they're not equal. They don't all have a legitimate belief that they deserve the center stage. It's that there are a lot of different people competing for that spotlight. Mm-hmm. And it gets to be really a family, food fight mm-hmm. over who gets the microphone today, who gets the conch today. Mm-hmm. And right now, on the right, it's really easy. It's Donald Trump. And you can actually see this playing out because Donald Trump has established the metric or the protocol for getting attention. Mm-hmm. And I forget who said this the other day. It used to be you don't want to say crazy shit. Yeah. Now it's you have to say the craziest shit you can think of or people will ignore you.
Yeah.
And so Ben Carson is just pulling shit out of his ass. Ben Carson,
about whom it was revealed today, did research with fetal cell tissue.
Yeah.
As a doctor. Of course he did.
Well, that was from a virgin birth. That God.
Well, then that's the baby Jesus fetal tissue. You can't use that.
It's I don't. Well, and this is where this is the if I may use a Mr. Robot term. Mm-hmm. Demanding consistency or being indignant about the fact that these people are completely hypocritical about everything mm-hmm. is the honeypot into which liberals fall, because there's no one to convince anymore. There's no bunch of people out there just waiting. Oh, you know, I was really on the fence about Ben Carson until you pointed out that he's inconsistent about this one thing. And now forget it. I'm going with Rand Paul. No. You missed the point. The point is, what I think is interesting, and this is why I sort of tentatively entitled this Welcome to Political Fiction Writing 101, is the method by which communication is getting done on the right tells you all about why Megyn Kelly is in trouble, mm-hmm. why mm-hmm. Eric Erickson is in trouble, why Jeb Bush tripped over his own dick again, mm-hmm. And why Bill O'Reilly's still on the air. And I can tie all those things together in about 3 minutes.
Go right ahead.
All right. There is one irrevocable rule you are not allowed to break in the official conservative narrative. Any given day, there's an official conservative story, an official Fox News history of America. It's wrong. It's fucked up. It is fraught with lies. It is full of contradictions. If you dig into it more than an inch, you'll find out that this is the opposite of what they said yesterday, which is the opposite of what they said the day before, and so on. But there's always an official party line, and there's always an official centrist party line, which is very easy to spot because it's always both sides everything. So the one inviolate rule that you are never supposed to break, because it causes the whole house of cards to collapse, is you never bring up the past. You can bring up...
We talked about this before. Yeah. I realize we're repeating ourselves, so we'll... But there were some specific instances this week.
Yes, exactly. That Megyn Kelly, and you never bring up the past. Never. You can bring up the official past. The official past, for example, is that George Bush won the Iraq War.
Right. And
that's the official
Barack
past.
Obama pissed it away.
And then Barack Obama pissed it away. And that's,
so we need a third Bush to finally get it right.
Finally. And that's the – so Jeb Bush is taking the official Roger Ailes approved history – and presenting it as his platform.
As fact,
now,
yes.
The fact that any competent 9-year-old could demolish that argument with about 3 different questions mm-hmm. simply points up the fact that it is the job of the mainstream media to keep competent 9-year-olds the hell away from candidates.
Yeah.
Because we don't want those questions asked, because Jeb Bush would look – because could you imagine Jeb Bush like saying – excuse me, and dropping the mic and going off stage to ask Bill Kristol what he's supposed to say when somebody pointed out, no, the surge didn't work, and it's a lie. And anyway, the status of force agreement was signed by your brother. So, I mean, he doesn't know what to say because he's just mouthing words that Roger Ailes gave him to say mm-hmm. to make this problem go away. But it all plays into the overall narrative of you never, ever, ever bring up the fucking past. Megyn Kelly brought up the past. And to leap to her aid... Bless his crazy goat fucking child molester heart. Eric Erickson leapt into the fray to defend Megyn Kelly from this obnoxious son of a bitch, Donald Trump, and his terrible things. Do you know he says terrible things about women? My wife's going to be at my stupid event. My kids are going to be there. I can't have this misogynist asshole on stage because being an onstage misogynist asshole is my job. Mm-hmm. And so Eric Erickson made the cardinal mistake of opening the book on the past. And what happened? Three mouse clicks later, everybody suddenly remembers, oh yeah, Eric Erickson is a huge asshole, a huge bigoted misogynist asshole. And here's picture after picture, clip after clip, tweet after tweet, article after article of him doing exactly what he's pissed that Donald Trump just did.
And the thing is, liberals didn't even need to go look that up.
No, it's
it's in our heads that he said goat fucking child molester about a Supreme Court justice.
Right. And it's at our fingertips. Yeah. And so that's why the rule exists. Because once you open the door to not the Fox-approved narrative alt-history past, but the actual past, once you start quoting Donald Trump's actual words back at him, everything unravels. Because suddenly we're actually talking, oh, no, that's the past we all agreed to forget, remember? Remember, we're all on board with that, right? Suddenly Megyn Kelly's not on board with that. And, of course, she was doing Roger Ailes' bidding. So what happened? So Donald Trump, and this is why we have reminded our listeners, or I have, because I'm a pedantic about it, that Bill O'Reilly still hasn't been suspended. Brian Williams has. And if you'll remember, about a million years ago, it was David Korn wrote an article in Mother Jones about the fact that Bill O'Reilly has a Brian Williams problem. Mm-hmm. But Bill O'Reilly lies about things a lot. Bill O'Reilly made shit up too. Bill O'Reilly this, Bill O'Reilly that. How come you're all indignant about Brian Williams but not Bill O'Reilly? And Rachel Maddow was suddenly running, 10-minute segments on, why the hell is that? Here's this.
Well, let me read a letter from MD on Facebook about Rachel Maddow, since you just brought that up.
Uh-huh.
She wrote me on Facebook and said, I'm going to be relying even more heavily on the Professional Left podcast for sane and insightful commentary on the issues of the day.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to watch the Rachel Maddow show on Tuesday evening. I still feel dirty and disgusted. What the heck is MSNBC doing? The show led with intensive coverage of the Republican debate with special focus on the Donald.
Right.
I feel like I need to take a Silkwood shower.
Don't we all?
And this was really good that she pointed this out. When 10 minutes into the show, the host who was subbing for Rachel introduced some field reporter. The field reporter said this, "We're working on getting past whatever inflammatory statements Trump made and trying to get to the meat of his stances on the important issues."
There you go. Let's ignore.
And MD says, "Working on getting past his inflammatory statements?
Mm-hmm.
Why should anyone have to get past what Donald Trump has been saying all along? He's a monster. He's a national embarrassment. No one should be taking him seriously. But that is not the purpose of the news media
to
judge whether a candidate should be taken seriously or not."
Inflammatory statements are his platform.
Yeah.
And so we are discussing his platform.
And he has changed gear now to substanceless inflammatory statements. He has switched over to substanceless statements about how awesome he will be.
Yeah. And if
he has turned the corner.
As you might recall, Tuesday night or Monday night, every single cable network was sitting on their ass waiting for him to show up.
Mm-hmm.
They all had their cameras pointed at an empty podium.
As if he's already president.
As if he's always.
Frankly.
And I really believe he was backstage getting a Hummer from Roger Ailes. Just a nice relaxing blow job from Roger Ailes before I go on microphone. Because what the punchline of this whole thing was, they couldn't bulldoze him and they couldn't shove him out of the way and they couldn't shut him out because he's too rich and he's too loud and he has too much savvy. And so they cut a deal. The CEOs, the Ailes and Trump went into the back room like in The Godfather, the meeting of the five families, the real powers behind the media went in the back room and they signed a truce. And the reason this worked, and again, I want to bring back us back to Bill O'Reilly. Rachel Maddow, had for a while, was very intensely interested in why the hell this double standard? Why? And then, of course, that whole controversy died under the porch, crawled under the porch and died. Yep. And the reason it worked was Bill O'Reilly followed the Fox News protocol for when you get caught lying in public, which is, number one, attack the reporter. Number two, deny everything. Number three, demand an apology from the, you know, double down. No,
yeah.
Fuck you. You owe me an apology.
Apologize to me. Yes.
And number four, talk about your ratings.
Your ratings. That's, it was so O'Reilly-esque.
It was right. And he, all Donald Trump was take that playbook. Attack Megyn Kelly, demand an apology from her, deny everything. I'm not over the top. I'm perfectly.
I was talking about bleeding out of her nose. Yeah. I was talking about bleeding out of her ears. I don't know. Only a disgusting evil person would suggest that that was about menstruation.
Oh, I forgot
that
part.
What are you talking about?
I forgot that part. Can't you take a joke? Can't you take a joke? And of course, in the end,
only a disgusting person would go there. I never thought that.
Yeah, and then, right. And then, of course, talk about your poll numbers. Hey, look, it's not me. It's the polls. It's not
me.
Only
go by the polls. I'm winning everywhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, what if you're because everyone who works for Roger Ailes, let's face it, is a sock puppet. Mm-hmm. They, you know, some of them are female with blonde and breasts, and some of them are men who wear suits, but they're all sock puppets. And Donald Trump simply took the Bill O'Reilly playbook for coping, the Roger Ailes approved playbook for coping with attacks, and turned it back on her. What the fuck? And that method of going after people who call you wrong. Remember, the base doesn't care about right or wrong. They don't care about policy. They don't care about lies or truth. They care about losing. You're a loser. Yeah. And Donald Trump came off like a winner.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com. I want to give a shout out to a group called The Yarn Mission. They're on Facebook and they have a website, theyarnmission.com. They are Ferguson's Radical Knitters. And you can tell I'm just ready to cry over this because I just love them already. I've been in touch with them and I'm getting ready to send them some yarn. The Yarn Mission is a group of knitters who meet at a coffee house in Ferguson. They are very involved. There was an article about them in The Guardian. They are knitting for the revolution. They are really interested in getting people to sit down and talk about police brutality and racial justice. And it's interesting to me because they clearly are discovering that sitting down and knitting brings people to the table, and then you start talking with them about police brutality.
Right.
It's like, oh.
Right.
What are you making? I'm making a cowl that's going to help the movement against police brutality. Really? Oh, that's interesting. Anyway, they are doing more than that. They are actually going into the Ferguson Florissant School District and starting knitting after-school programs in this predominantly black, obviously, predominantly black school district. They have had 40 girls sign up to learn to knit. And that is not sitting around learning to knit. That is sitting around getting mentored.
Exactly, exactly.
Social action.
And community. And a feeling of community. That's right.
Yep, and you're going to learn self-esteem, and you're going to learn what your voice sounds like, and you're going to learn to knit. As a side bonus, you will learn to knit. So they are doing a yarn drive in the month of August, and of course I volunteered to say, I have a little bit of extra yarn.
There's no such thing. as my wife has taught me.
I have yarn that I will donate to the revolution.
There you go.
Put it that way.
There's no such thing as extra yarn, you idiot.
Extra yarn, yeah. But I am going to donate some yarn to the revolution by sending it to the Yarn Mission in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And I gave them a shout out on Ravelry, which is the knitting website. And there is the organizer of the Yarn Mission is on Ravelry. And she and I have friended each other. So that's awesome. And it's just, you know, I just want to really hold that up as saying, awesome, go for it, support that, great.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I found a quote. It's just talking about, again, the sort of primary battle stuff that goes on.
Right.
And really, we in the social justice movement need to protect each other from hurt feelings and going all shouty at this point, because everything seems so important all the time when you're an activist. And that's good. That passion, as I said before, is awesome.
Yeah.
But please, please take care of yourselves and keep your eye on the prize, because this is a long battle that we're involved in. And there is a writer named Katrina Katzenbach who I don't know anything about her, but a quote from her came across my email, and I wanted to share. And it's about her fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But it meant a lot to me, and it dovetails nicely with what we've been talking about. She says, "I'm comfortable in uncomfortable places. I don't kill everyone in my books, but I don't shy away from experiences of danger, extremity, or pain in any way. And not all my characters are likable, pleasant, or redeeming. I try to make them interesting." And her goal, of course, is to write a working plot of fiction.
Right.
That makes sense and is publishable.
And you will read. You'll keep turning the page.
You'll be entertained by it and that you'll want to read.
Right.
And then you'll want to read the next one.
Right.
But we need to take, I think we need to take that and put it into our journals, our instruction manuals, of not shying away from experiences of being confronted with our own racism, being confronted with our own privilege, being confronted with, and on the other side, being confronted with, hey, you know, maybe we in Black Lives Movement, maybe those that are in Black Lives Movement, need to find a way to be clearer about what our goals are. They did listen. They are protesting at
yes.
other candidates' forums.
Yes, they are.
You know, there was and there was discussion from lots of different sides, as I saw on Twitter, because I do read the Black Lives Matter tweets, between people who said, ignore the Republicans.
Right.
Because they're never going to help us. And we really need to focus on the Democratic platform and make sure they don't take us for granted. That's the only place we're going to make any progress.
Mm-hmm.
And other people in the Black Lives Movement saying, no, this is America. And
right.
our voice needs to be everywhere. And so, you know, that can be an uncomfortable conversation to have. But don't be afraid of it. And at the same time, protect yourself from getting burnt out, from getting angry at people who should be your friends,
mm-hmm.
and recognize that we're a family and we're going to move forward together because Jeb Bush wants to fix Iraq again.
He does. He's adorable. He wants to fix Iraq.
It's going
to
be African-American men going over there to fight.
Yeah.
Don't have any illusions about that.
No, it's always, you know, rich man's war, poor man's fight.
Right.
Always has been, always will be. And the part about fiction writing, I take that entire thing to heart, and I'd like to talk for a minute about fiction writing itself. Mm-hmm. Because you touched on the two major parts of fiction writing, character and plot. Mm-hmm. And if you view this period of time, this election, really the last maybe, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, as character and plot, there are two, as I said already, two prevailing narratives that dominate our political dialogue. One is the right-wing message, the Fox News narrative, and one is the centrist narrative. And obviously I don't agree with either one of them, I think they're both terrible, but the efficacy of a story depends on competent, coherent plot and characters and details. And we've reached the point where neither one of these narratives can sustain the plot anymore because it's so transparently stupid. The characters are absurd. On their face, they're absurd. And they can't talk about details anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So from a strictly a fiction narrative point of view, their stories are falling apart before our eyes.
You mentioned that, you know, having a story, that is an essential part of campaigning for any office.
It is.
It is. They have the voter has to get to know you personally. That's why Johnny Ernst got elected.
Yeah.
She has this, you know, scrappy, I grew up on a farm story that people identified with.
Hog castrator.
All the candidates wanted to talk about their middle class, working class dads mm-hmm. on the stage. But the stories that the Republican candidates are telling are so full of lies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Just to give one obvious glaring example, Carly Fiorina.
Yeah.
You know, oh, and I was a businesswoman, and she's not mentioning any of the details.
Well, she's
a glorious business career.
But within the conservative canon, that's acceptable.
Yes.
The problem is when the canonical details of the conservative fiction turn on itself.
Mm-hmm.
When Donald Trump starts talking about other people's pasts, when Eric Erickson starts bringing up the past, when Jeb Bush wanders into an Iraqi minefield, that's when it gets interesting because Carly Fiorina can lie all she wants and no one on the right is going to call her on it. Carly Fiorina can lie all she wants, and no one in the center is going to say anything other than, well, she's doing really well in the polls. Mm-hmm. And hey, let's talk about Bernie Sanders. Yeah. So I really think it is, from my personal point of view, focusing on the fact that Carly Fiorina is a liar is pointless. Mm-hmm. Because nobody cares. What intrigues me are the places where the light leaks through, the places where we can actually sink a crowbar and pry something loose. Because you're never, I mean, you know, the Twitter is full of battles with conservatives who are just lying, who are just morons. They're just, as I said before, you're arguing pod bay doors with Hal, mm-hmm. and nothing is going to change. What I find interesting is, for example, this very minor example from MSNBC. Craig Melvin, who's one of the up-and-coming whatever the hell this network is turning into. As I noted the other day, next week NBC plans to replace Morning Joe with a tire fire and a big sign reading, "Yes, we hate liberals. Take the hint already." You know, MSNBC is dying before your eyes.
Yep.
So we should stop pretending it's really anything other than Fox Light at this point, with a couple of liberal cherries on top. And those people are operating under obviously extremely tight constraints on what they can and cannot talk about. Mm-hmm. Because when you have someone on there, when you have Tim Pawlenty on the Lawrence O'Donnell show, Teapaw, talking about Iraq and talking about Barack Obama, you know, failing and fucking up and pulling out too soon and how it's his fault, the obvious answer, the obvious question, the obvious assertion would be, well, wait a minute, didn't that status of force agreement get signed by George W. Bush? And Lawrence O'Donnell sat there grinning through gritted teeth and said nothing, because somebody has explained to him that you don't work for liberal TV anymore. You work for CNN Lite or Fox Lite, and you're going to keep it in your pants or you're going to get yourself fired. So Craig Melvin and some person he was talking to were having this exchange about Donald Trump, because he's the only person anyone talks about, which I think is tragically hilarious. And it was, man, you know, nobody saw this coming. Nobody saw this coming. And, you know, months ago, it was like, well, he's going to die. And then he said the McCain thing. And he flummoxed us all. He flabbergasted everyone. And once again, here's a moment where if anybody had Chris Hayes' home phone number or had any ability to talk to anyone on the networks and say, actually, there were a group of people who saw him coming. And there are a group of people who aren't surprised at all that Donald Trump is doing so well. Those people are called liberals. And they've been talking about the coming of the Trump phenomena for years. They talked about it when it was Palin. They talked about it when it was Cruz. This is not one person. This is the emergent property of a long series of tragically horrible fascistic mistakes and takeovers of our media and our politics by rich plutocrats. And there are a group of people who've been right about this all along. What is fascinating to me is the more Donald Trump grows to dominate the media cycle, the more obsessed, either by omission or commission, Fox News, CNN, and MSNBC are about not letting liberals talk about it, keeping us the fuck away from the microphone.
Yep.
Donald Trump can do his second round of full Ginsburg phone calls to the networks, and they will let him do that. They will let him just dial in to every major Sunday show 2 weeks in a row, which is unheard of. They'll let him have a press conference like he was president of the United States, but they will not allow one liberal anywhere near a microphone to say that Donald Trump is nothing more or less than the Republican Party that we've been warning you about for 30 years, because that would destroy both the conservative media narrative and the centrist media narrative. And it is that which is prohibited is what I find fascinating. That which the hill that NBC is willing to die on is, thou shalt not talk about how fucking awful the media is. And that's fascinating to me. It's tragic. I feel like Josephus sometimes, you know, gathering a few books from burning Jerusalem to preserve them for a future generation, and writing the history that I hope someday someone will read.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Bootsy Collins. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And don't forget our Amazon link at our website. We believe in buying local. But we also believe in shopping Amazon with our link if your alternative is a big box store.
Mm-hmm.
So don't go to Walmart. If you need to buy something from Walmart, buy it with our link at Amazon and support our podcast.
That's Thank right.
You. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address are there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Oh, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties cannot wait for that Lincoln Chafee documentary to air on the Sundance Channel.
Let's think about living. Think about living. Let's think about loving. Think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovin'. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
We have a new Science Fiction University contributor again. Next week, we will be back with Dogface Herman. I'm promising that because he's got a good one he sent us, and I want to use it.
Okay.
But I want to get these new contributors recognized as well. Stephen in California has sent some Science Fiction University questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's got a message for you, Driftglass.
Everybody does, Blue Gal.
These questions all relate to the greatest science fiction book of all time, Frank Herbert's Dune.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty good book.
But here's a note to you.
Uh-huh.
If Driftglass interrupts you, he's talking to me, Blue Gal,
uh-huh,
with a quip about Starship Troopers or another work of Heinlein, inform him he is just wrong about this and is starting the quiz with a score of -1.
You know, that reminds me of a collection of Heinlein short stories called The Unpleasant Profession of Jonathan Hoag. Let me tell you about that. Blah, blah, 1 hour later, blah, blah. All right. I take your warning seriously, Stephen from California.
Stephen in California, I think, wants to get into an argument with you in the con suite for fun.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Well, you know, staged arguments are always fun in a con suite.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you throw your drink, usually a plastic cup full of cheap beer, into the roaring fireplace. There's never a fireplace. There's usually a crappy TV. And storm out because Ursula Le Guin is underrated by male chauvinist assholes.
All right. Let's get the quiz underway.
Mm-hmm.
These are all about Dune.
Okay.
And you'll probably get a lot of these right.
Love Dune. I have an autographed copy of Children of Dune on my tiny bookshelf. So.
All right. Question one.
Uh-huh.
What is, and pardon me, I have not read Dune, so if I get any of these pronunciations wrong, I would like you to take your cheap plastic cup of beer and throw it at the fireplace. All right.
Okay. It's pronounced Frank Herbert.
Herbert.
So, okay.
Question one. What is Shai Hulud?
Oh, the worm, the sandworm, the giant worm.
Yes.
The god of the planet, really. And a really good god because it's really there. It's very living and present and terrifying and huge.
And, Stephen says, if he says Satan, inform him that is Shaitan.
Yeah, no. It's Shai Hulud.
All right. Question two. Describe the life cycle of a sandworm.
Well, you know, like any other poor child, they were born.
Mommy sandworm and daddy sandworm love each other very much.
That's exactly how it happens. So they have to start off very, very small, and they get very, very, very big, and I'm pretty sure they have adolescence where they're sullen and hate their parents.
Okay.
Other than that, I don't know.
Sand trout converge around a deep water source and excrete a chemical that reacts with the water into something they can digest. When the concentration becomes too high, it forms into a pre-spice mass that will eventually explode.
That I remember.
The sand trout that survive the explosion metamorphose into small sandworms.
Oh, okay.
It is implied that the sandworms release spores that eventually grow into sand trout. So,
sandworms. I totally don't remember the sand trouts at all.
Yeah.
But the rest of it sounds familiar.
You'll get this one.
Okay.
What is the holy book in the Imperium?
Oh, that's the Orange Catholic Bible.
Very good.
Yeah.
What is the chief commandment of the Orange Catholic Bible and why?
As I recall, it had to do with the Ixian War, where everybody was, technology had gotten way out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was technologized. So it was, that's why everything is mechanical now. From the ornithopters to human beings trained to think like computers.
Mm-hmm.
So it has something to do with technology and technology being bad.
Right. Okay. His answer is, thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of the human mind.
Yeah.
Long before the current time described in the book, humanity created artificial intelligences which rebelled and enslaved humanity. Humanity freed itself during a struggle known as the Butlerian Jihad.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And destroyed all sentient machines.
Mm-hmm.
And another acceptable answer is, thou shalt not disfigure the soul.
Mm-hmm.
It's a more generic version of the same commandment that also covers modifying humanity beyond an acceptable baseline, pursuing artificial intelligence, or utilizing atomic weapons against humans.
Yes, all right. Atomic weapons are kept. Each great house has its own atomic weapons that are not supposed to be used except under extreme circumstances.
All right. I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, but
all right.
Who were the Bene Tilax? Tleilax?
Mm. Oh.
Bene?
You got me. I remember the Bene Gesserit or the witches.
Okay, well, the Bene Tleilax were an authoritarian organization of men who fabricated a variety of human beings for commercial and military uses.
Huh.
They fabricated golas, or clones,
that
for a variety of ends, such as slavery, sexual slavery, nostalgia, bribery, and mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
They fabricated face dancers as assassins. They trained mentats to be living computers.
Yep. Benny T.
Tleilaxu masters even cloned themselves as a mean of reproduction. Give Driftglass a bonus point if he states that the Bene Tleilax turned the women of their culture into axolotl tanks.
Okay, that, yeah.
Basically, they used their wombs to grow their various other products.
Yeah. One of the main characters in Dune is called Duncan Idaho. And he is killed, as I recall. And he is returned as a gift to Paul, because Paul trusts him implicitly, with machine eyes. Mm-hmm. And he'd been grown, a clone of him had been grown, and Paul knows that, but he also thinks he can trust him. And he's sort of he's like the the Alan Adale in Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
You're never sure if you can trust him.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes for an interesting bit of conflict for the main character, as I recall, but I think he was grown in one of those tanks that I can't pronounce, Xlotl or something.
Okay.
Anyway, so I don't get that one.
No. Question 6. Where did Paul Atreides get his chosen name?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What is Muad'Dib?
Yeah.
What is that?
Paul Atreides, great house, wiped out, living on Dune, had a dream that he would be called Muad'Dib. He'd be called after the moon, the small moon. There's a shadow on the moon that looks like one of the rodents on the planet.
Very good.
He sees what that dream implies. It implies he will lead a jihad,
mm-hmm,
that will kill billions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's trying desperately to modify the future, which he sees as becoming more and more inevitable. So he calls himself Paul Muad'Dib, which he hopes can deflect slightly from the future that he sees.
And a Muad'Dib is a small kangaroo mouse found,
that's right,
on his home planet of Arrakis. Yes.
That's right.
Okay. What is Paul Atreides' siege name, and what does it mean?
Oh, yeah, that's his tribal name.
Mm-hmm.
One that is known only to his crew.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Usul or Usul.
Very good.
It means the bottom of the pillar.
Base of the pillar.
The thing that supports everything else.
You got that exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
Number 8. What is the Lansrad?
Or
rod.
Lansrad, yeah, it has two A's in it, as I recall.
Right, two A's.
Lansrad has, It's like the parliament of all the great houses. It's
very
like it's where they all meet. It's you know, and there's the Harkonnens and the Atreides and a bunch of other. It's a feudal system. There's an emperor and the barons, the owners of rulers of planets, and this is their sort of form of baronial government.
Here's how right you got that.
Uh-huh.
Landsraad was the deliberative body composed of representatives of the feudal great houses.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes used interchangeably with the great houses as a whole. Okay. Mm-hmm. What is Choam? Choam.
Oh, shit. I want to say Harkonnen, but that's not right. It's an acronym, and it's a combine. It's a corporation. It's a big-ass corporate thing that runs everything.
That's right, and it is an acronym that stands for Combine, Honet, Ober, Advancer, Mercantile.
Mercantile, that's right.
Imperium-wide corporation in charge of all interplanetary commerce. Mm-hmm. All directors and shares are held by members of the Landsraad, the Emperor, the Spacing Guild, or the Bene Gesserit.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
Last one is kind of a humorous question.
Okay.
But I'll read it to you anyway. The following are characteristics of the Imperium at the start of Dune.
Mm-hmm.
One, all commerce is controlled by a single corporation owned by the feudal overlords. Two, a single monotheistic religion is enforced by the power of the state. Three, cutthroat internal politics keep it in a continual low state of warfare with itself. Four, women don't own their own bodies. Five, mass incarceration is at such a point that whole planets are given over to it.
Mm-hmm.
Six, distrust of science and technology are mandated. And seven, the general population is uneducated, servile, and used as cannon fodder in the wars of feudal overlords.
Yeah. Yeah.
Question 10. Does this remind you of the platform of any political party in the United States?
Well, I would add one thing to that, too.
Yeah.
The entire economy of the galaxy depends on control of a single resource.
Yeah.
Because without that thing, the ships don't fly, the machines don't move, nothing happens. And in our world, it's oil. Yeah. And in Dune, it's spice. So, yeah, and of course, the people who are constantly fighting over control of this most valuable resource in the galaxy.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Green Party. The short answer is it's the Green Party. Yeah.
Can you explain what happens to the Imperial planetologist in Dune?
Oh, yeah. Keaton?
I don't have a name for him.
Okay. Alex P. Keaton. Yeah. I remember he was played by, what's his name? Now,
what happens to him in Dune?
He's murdered.
Yeah.
He's murdered. His still suit is sabotaged, and he's put out on the planet. And I believe he is swallowed up in a spice explosion.
Okay, he's murdered by the Harkonnen, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the Harkonnen are evil.
And no one but the Freeman cared mm-hmm. what he did.
Right. And he was the one who was working with the Fremen, or the Freeman, to in secret, to help them with their great project, which is to make the planet bloom. And beneath Dune, the Fremen have hidden an ocean of water,
mm-hmm.
Little by little, drop by drop. And the plan was that they're going to make their planet into something habitable and lovely. And he was working with them on that. And he was an honored outsider among the Fremen.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Stephen in California.
Ah, I like that one.
Deeply appreciate it.
Yeah. Good book.
Yeah.
Very, very good book.
Yep. We are going to talk for a minute about Mr. Robot. The only thing I want to say about Mr. Robot is if you haven't watched this week's episode, rearrange your entire life.
Yeah.
And go do that.
Put all the pickle forks away.
Really?
You'll be freaked out. By the end of the episode, you won't ever want to see a pickle fork again. Or an olive fork. Or whatever she was using. Man.
Crazy.
She's a cold man.
There's a crazy woman in this episode. Well, but I don't want to give too many spoilers away.
Lady Macbeth.
Just turn it off at this point. Turn off the podcast if you haven't seen it.
Remember when Lady Macbeth says, "Unsex me now"?
Yeah.
Make me a man, because she will do literally anything to advance her husband's career. Mm-hmm. And there is the action of this character, which I won't talk about any more than that, is a minor part of this, the whole episode. That would be the climax of any other show. It was one of many, many astounding moments in this week's Mr. Robot, which we now reserve time to watch. Because it's really, really good. And it's a Philip Dick novel. Yeah. There is something either in Philip Dick fiction, there's often a protagonist who doesn't know who he is or is actually not who he thinks he is.
Mm-hmm.
He is a psychological construct of some other person. And he has a personality and he walks and he talks and he acts like a person. But the person you are interacting with for some part of the story is not who is really going on here.
Yeah.
And it's quite remarkable.
There's so much that is revealed. And I guess what I wanted to do was contrast this show mm-hmm. with the show that precedes it on USA Network called Suits.
Yeah.
Which I used to watch. I used to be a Suits fanatic and I used to watch Suits. I think Suits was advertised as being similar in plot to Mr. Robot. There was this genius guy who had a special skill of, you know, instant recall and instant memorization of whole law books. Like, he could just instantly... He passed the bar exam for other people because he'd read something and he'd remember it forever. And he'd remember the page number it was on. And he was just one of these very weird geniuses that had this skill. And he would self-medicate with pot, and he would self-medicate with other things. He was kind of sort of a drug dealer, and he hung out with drug dealers, and he was a street guy.
Mm-hmm.
And running away from the cops, he encounters this very well-dressed, high-powered attorney who is interviewing Harvard Law graduates for a clerkship in the firm. And the secretary who becomes this really sassy character in the story is supposed to screen candidates and say, look, you know, if you're not intellectually interesting, Harvey, who's the attorney, doesn't want you as a clerk. He doesn't want to suck up somebody he's going to have to train. He wants somebody that's really got some pizzazz. So here comes this genius kid who's escaping from the cops in a bad drug deal at the hotel where these interviews are going on.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks in and the secretary is sitting there and she says, may I help you? And he said, I just came in here so I wouldn't get arrested. And she sends him into the high-priced attorney's office with a thumbs up, like, this is our guy, right? Because he's got sass.
Right.
Well, this show now has boiled down to, I haven't watched it in a couple years, but I watched the last 2 minutes of it because Mr. Robot doesn't start until 9:01 or 9:02, right?
God damn it.
It goes until 10:17 or whatever.
Yeah.
They don't keep it on schedule. So I'm sitting there watching the last 2 minutes of a show I haven't watched in a couple of years. And it is just like a soap opera. Nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm.
This, now it's the evil lawyer is trying to take over the firm again, but he was trying to do that 2 years ago. This is just boring.
Bad guy in bad. It's a soap opera.
It's a soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
It is a soap opera. And it's all about whether this kid who was a genius. I mean, that was part of he was a weird genius at the beginning of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's just in conflict with other attorneys over cases. And mm-hmm. his special skill isn't brought up at all ever. And it's just hideously boring. So then you turn on Mr. Robot last night after that, and so much has spun around in this mm-hmm. one episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I particularly love that, as I said to you, every single week there's a movie. It's a film.
It's being
put on.
Shot in New York.
Shot with a tremendous sense of what does the city look like. The city is a character in the play. You always know where you are,
right?
As you said. And the theme of last night's movie was the walls that we put around us and that hackers peek over the walls and see who you are, but no one can peek inside my wall. The hacker's wall is always impenetrable.
And this is why
I have to keep people out.
Hackers trust no one.
Hackers trust no one. Mm-hmm. We won't let anyone see inside our walls. And by the end of the episode, you realize that Elliot, the character who's narrating this whole story, he hasn't looked over his own wall in years.
And he does, and he finds something shocking.
Yes, absolutely shocking. Mm-hmm. Absolutely shocking.
About himself.
You have no idea that this could be the case.
And the thing is, and we're going to talk about this in the regular, in our sort of regular podcast, this is an incredibly adept work of fiction. Because, first of all, the details are so good. You know, when you take a screenshot of the computer that so-and-so is using, who said such and such 3 episodes ago, by God, he's using the software he said he used. And it's right there in the inline code that he's typing right in front of you. There are really amazing plot twists, really amazing reversals, but they don't violate anything that has come before. You don't have to retrofit what your plot is today to the shit you made up yesterday, because the writers had no idea this was going to happen. And this would be cool. Hey, let's make the island a time travel machine. Instead, it all makes perfect sense. And so when you find out that the two main female protagonists have known each other for years, it makes perfect sense. Oh, of course. They're in a ballet class together. And at no point did it not make sense. At no point were we ever told this isn't happening. It just was like, well, this guy's leading like very compartmentalized life. And he has this group of people that he hacks with at night and this group of people he works with by day. And he doesn't let those two things cross because that would break everything. And you find out that, oh, my God, all the people know each other. And there are relationships and interrelationships. And oh my goodness. And of course it makes sense. It makes in retrospect, it makes perfect sense that would in fact be the case. And we also meet the shark. We also meet White Rose.
Yeah. Or at least someone who represents White Rose at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
White Rose, this particular person, I love how you're not really sure if this person is male or female.
Yes.
I love how you're really not sure whether this person is adult or child, frankly. I felt like, wow, this person is kind of
surreal.
Surreal, right. And on purpose, a cipher that will not be solved in any way.
Except the entire building that he's in when they meet is a fortress.
Yep.
It is absolutely protected from everything. And that couldn't be the case unless
that person is selected to be there by the organization,
and it's in plain sight. This massive hacking fortress is right in plain sight. And the exchange between them, again, the thing that is breathtaking is there are like 4 different storylines going on at once. And you're never confused about where you are, what's going on,
and
who knows who.
That's hard.
It's really hard to do. And I am
do it so well. We're just in love with this show. So go watch it.
And we saw a gun.
We saw guns. Yeah.
And you know the rule.
A gun at one place, you got to have it fired off someplace else.
You better have it fired. So and now I don't know. This show has broken lots of those kinds of rules.
Yeah.
But I heard an interview with one of the writer or a mention of the interview with the writer saying, oh, no, this season is just the setup.
Oh, yeah, right.
The real story is once you get all of this sort of narration and exposition out of the way, the real story is coming like at the end of the season. And now that is, of course, what you say to hardcore junkies like me to ensure that we watch, obsessed over every little detail. And, you know, we zip it back and we look at, when Elliot's on the subway, the woman next to him has a parrot on her shoulder. Mm-hmm. I never noticed that because I was really focused on plot and character. But even if that's half true, it bodes very well for this particular story. It's really good. It's obviously we both enjoy it very much.
Yeah.
I don't walk around all day buttonholing people, telling them what TV shows to watch. But this is like pressing, Dune into their hands, or pressing Ray Bradbury, you know, the Martian Chronicles into someone's hands. They read this. It's really good. I'm not telling you to go become a science fiction addict or to watch a lot of TV. Most of what's on television is junk. This is an exception. And truly.
And universally acknowledged as an exception. I mean, I don't think I've seen anyone say, it's kind of good. That's sort of all right, I guess, if you like that sort of thing. No, everybody is in love with this show. So
I don't know.
Glad we discovered it from the beginning. And, you know, I pat myself on the back for being wired enough into it to say. But I'm also just so glad that we live in a time where people can now, you know, this is episode 7. People can this weekend go watch it.
Right.
From the beginning. And, you know, if we had time, if we didn't have kids coming home Saturday night, I would spend my Saturday in front of the set knitting and watching 7.5 hours of Mr. Robot.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and you've given me an idea because, as we've discussed before, I could make a tidy living as a conservative commentator. I will become I will write the contrarian reviews.
Oh, no.
Robot. You know,
get everyone on Facebook hating you.
No, it's not that great. I remember
not really that great.
You want to know great? You want to hear no great? Allie McBeal, two words. Allie McBeal.
That really broke the mold, and really? That was it.
Really, you know, Boston Legal. Okay,
Boston Legal. If you haven't watched the whole thing from the beginning, I don't know what to tell you. All right,
this is just LA law with computers. That's really all it is.
All right, everyone. I love you, Driftglass.
Love you too, baby.
And thank you. To Stephen in California, and we'll be back next week. More Science Fiction University. Yeah.
Everybody, bye.